to tzitzis, to sukkah, to matzah, and then get everybody back in time for our next step of our presentation. So we're going to be most of Adobe beforehand that we may not finish everything, but at least we're going to try to do our best. So every once in a while, we bump into the following signs that may catch your attention. We probably look at them, read them really quickly, and think that they're pretty much irrelevant for us. So let me just share a few of those kinds of signs that you may see, and then we'll try to use them almost like a little bit of a springboard for our sugya. Sometimes you're invited to a Hachnasa Sefer Torah, and you may be even honored to be one of those people who's called upon to write one of the letters, and you know, they call you up, mechubad, with writing the last letter, and you see there's this big sign in your face that says, Hineni kosev sefer azel l'shem kedusha sefer Torah, and the sofa tells you like 20 times, make sure to read this and say it and understand it, and you're beginning to shake and think, and if I goof, I just blew the $80,000 sefer Torah, relax, don't worry about it. There's no way that if you didn't say that l'shma, the sefer Torah is going to be possible. But the bottom line is, that's one sign that sometimes catches your attention. You may have noticed something slightly a little bit less blatant. If you, every once in a while, you notice that your ritzuos on your tefillin are starting to scratch up a little bit, and someone gives you the great idea, hey, why don't you like paint them up a little bit? Let me give you this magic marker that I bought. So you take out this magic marker, and you're about to, you know, blacken up your ritzuos a little bit, and the guy skews you, don't forget to say what it says in the marker. And you take off your glasses, you can't, it says in letters about that big, before you say this, before you mark in your tefillin, don't forget to say, L'shem Kedushas tefillin. And you start to shake and think, oh my goodness gracious, and if I goofed that, so my grandfather's tefillin just got puzzled, I have to go up to Sheamus. Relax, hang in there, we'll try to calm you down then. You may sometimes see signs that say the following box of matzahs are being sold to you with every possible heder under the sun, and of course we know every heder costs, adds a few more dollars to the box of matzahs. There's a general rule in life, in halacha, you pay per chumrah, and there's this big thing that says on it, these matzahs were made lishma, they were made by Shema Shabbos people, everything is gevaldik and unbelievable. There is one particular brand that it says on the box was made by Shema Shabbos people, why that's necessary, I'm not sure, but everything was done, lishma, l'shem, kedushas, dvar ma'aliyayinim. So we're kind of used to those kinds of signs, and I'll show you one last fourth sign, and then we'll try to understand what in the world's going on with all of this. How much of this is halacha, and how much of this is not. So another example goes back to an event that occurred back in our beloved yeshiva. This goes back, if I'm not mistaken, it was the first or second year of the yeshiva that I was there. It was in the early 80s, close to 40 years ago. And SOY at the time was running a tzitzis sale. I'm sure they've had since then several tzitzis sales. It was back in the early 80s. And there was a big sign in the Mishmanish that said that these tzitzis are going to be like mahadrim and a mahadrim. Last we checked, that's only necessary for Neres Chanukah, but they're going to be mahadrim and a mahadrim, the highest of the highest. And everything was done l'shma by men, without machines. Everything was done l'shma. Both the making of the strings as well as the sewing of the begodim were made l'shma. And I remember a few people were pointed out that the sewing of the begodim can take place in China by non-Jews. They don't have to be done l'shma. There's no kedusha, there's no mitzvah of the beged. The dinim of l'shma and tzitzis, if it at all exists, only applies to the strings. So we sometimes give a little bit of hype, a little bit of overdue to l'shma. Let's try to understand a little bit what this concept is all about, how it does actually speak to us, and when it is really necessary, when it's questionable necessary, when it's not necessary. Who can do the Shema? How do you do the Shema? So again, now that we knocked off the first 5 minutes of Shema, we have 23 and a half minutes left to discuss six different areas of halacha about what the Shema does and doesn't mean. So the sugya of the Shema, that an item, that a chefza, that's going to be used for some observance of a mitzvah or some halachic fulfillment, clearly exists. There is definitely a concept of a Shema in halacha. There are certain areas where the Shema is absolutely necessary, and the lack thereof is actually going to disqualify that item for the purposes of the mitzvah or for the halachic institution that I want to use it for. This year, the yeshiva is learning Maseches Gittin, and as we're going to hear in the get demonstration, so one of the areas where the Shema plays a critical role is in the realm of Hilchos Gittin. A get must be written in the Shema. If a get is not written in the Shema, the entire get is posel midda araisa. The get is not literally not worth the paper that it's written on. How do we know? Vishtate. Where is there a source for this? One word in Chumash. Lachos of law. Torah Rapeh says, law means lishma. What does lishma mean in the context of gittin? It means three things. The get has to be written for the purpose of this man, for the purpose of this woman, and for the purpose of gerushin. It has to be written for this explicit purpose of this man, Reuven, divorcing Rachel. That is the halacha of Lishma. The absence thereof will disqualify the get min HaTorah. Now, even though it's true that a get has to be written Lishma, as we will hopefully find out very soon, not all parts of the get have to be done Lishma mita araisa. There is the, what we call the chasimas haget, the signatures on the get. We paskin la'alocha min HaTorah don't have to be done Lishma, but midrabanan they do have to be done Lishma. So lamaisa, practically speaking, just about anything and everything that gets put onto that piece of paper is going to require the Shema. What that means, how you do it, and who can do it, hopefully we'll find out as we go on. So that's one area of halacha where the Shema is pretty clear, pretty obvious, pretty much accepted by everybody. Nuances of which part of the get needs the Shema, but the basic principle of doing it for the purpose of a get is absolutely critical. Let me move to another area. Ksivas, Kisvei HaKodesh, particularly the writing of a Sefer Torah, the writing of the Parshas for Tefillin, the writing of the Parshas for Mezuzos, all those halachas of Ksivas Kisvei HaKodesh. So this is actually a machlokes HaTorah. This is not as simple as a get. There actually is one opinion that says that you could write a Sefer Torah, not necessarily Lishma, which would even open up the possibility. We spoke a lot about this in Shir this year in Gittin. There's even one Tana, which we don't accept, that may even accept a Sefer Torah written by a non-Jew, believe it or not, as strange as that may sound, that maybe there is no requirement that a Sefer Torah be done for the purposes of Sefer Torah proper, but we don't paskin that way. We unequivocally paskin that a Sefer Torah that was written, it can be written with all the Idurim, it's beautiful, the nicest artistic craft work. If it wasn't done for the purpose of L'Shem Kedusha Sefer Torah, it's not worth the parchment that it's written on. That Sefer Torah is posel mida araisa. So we require a halacha, a Sefer Torah being written l'shma. Similarly, we require the parashas of Tefillin and the parashas of Mezuzah to be done l'shma. But not only does the Sefer Torah proper in terms of the writing be done l'shma, but certain preparations of the Sefer Torah have to also be l'shma. For example, what's called the Ibud Ha'or, the preparation of the animal skins. We're very far removed from the world of animals. Most of us, we don't have a clue. How do you get from an animal to a piece of parchment? So our knowledge of that is about one line of Maseches Gittin that tells us, well, you soak it in this, you soak it in that, you soak it in the other thing and hope for the best. So there is a process, what's called Ibud Ha'oros. B'chloikes HaTanoim, and we pass it in Halacha, Ibud Ha'or has to be done l'shma as well. So if you have a Sefer Torah that the animal skins were not processed l'shma for the express purpose of Sefer Torah, that Sefer Torah, once again, is not worth the cloth that it's written on. So you can have an $80,000 Sefer Torah that's written, that's puzzled with the Araisa, because not only must the Ksivas of Sefer Torah be l'shma, but the Ibud Ha'or, the early stages, the preliminary stages of processing the skin has to also be l'shma. This, in fact, led to a major, major crisis in the Middle Ages, particularly in the Ashkenazi community. Those who know a little bit about the, if you remember back from your medieval history days, so there was a part of society back in the Middle Ages, in the Dark Ages, into the Middle Ages, was there was a system of guilds and crafts, which pretty much boiled down to that if you wanted to be a shoemaker, you had to belong to the shoemaker club. And if you decided to make shoes and you weren't part of that club, so best case scenario, they would throw away your shoes. Worst case scenario, throw you to jail. Probably worst case scenario, they'd kill you. So you didn't want to break the rules. It wasn't like, you know, cross a picket line today. You know, it's not the nicest thing to do, but they're probably not going to kill you. They may want to, but they're not going to. But in those days, if you broke the rules of the guilds of the crafts, you were in serious trouble. So if you were not a shoemaker, you weren't making shoes. If you were not a tanner, if you were not someone who was given the permission by the local government to be producing parchment, you weren't doing that. Now, there was one small condition necessary in order to be part of a guild, to be part of those crafts. You had to be a Christian. And if you were Jewish, you were pretty much disqualified from being anything in the guild system, which, just in case you're interested, was the reason why Jews were pretty much, for hundreds of years, they were excluded from working in the crafts. They weren't permitted to own land, which made it very difficult for most people to make a parnasa. So you had two choices. Either you sat in coal all day and hoped someone was going to support you, which somebody had to go to work. And the other option was you had to figure out, finagle a way to make some money in business. So that's where the Jews were very involved in business, particularly in money lending, because they weren't allowed to do many, many of the other kinds of professions. So bottom line is that the tanning business, the processing skin business, was a huge problem because we had to have Sefer Torah, we had to have cloth for Sefer Torah, for Tefillin, etc. And the non-Jews weren't letting us make them. So we had to rely on the non-Jews making the animal skins, which ran into a whole serious problem about how do you do that lishma? How in the world do you get a non-Jew to do something lishma for you? So hopefully we'll have a little bit of time at the end of the shiur to try to figure out a kunst that was used to try to get around that problem. So this was a very real challenge, particularly again in the European communities. How do you get around writing a Sefer Torah properly, preparing the skins properly, in light of the fact that the halacha requires lishma? But when we leave the realm a little bit of Dvarim Shem Kedusha, things which have Shem Hashem, Psukim, Kitta Kodesh, we enter into the realm of Dvarim Shel Mitzvah. Now, Dvarim Shel Mitzvah, I mean things such as tzitzis, sukkot, lulav, matzahs, those kinds of things. If you want to think about what makes up a davarship of kedusha and what makes up a davarship of mitzvah, usually the test case will be, what do you do with that item after you've finished using it? Do you throw it into the garbage or do you have to put it into shemos? So davarship of kedusha, an old Sefer Torah has to be buried, an old pair of tefillin has to be buried, and all the lulav doesn't have to be buried, an old pair of tzitzis does not have to be buried. Most can say we wrap it up in a nice, respectful way and then throw it into the garbage with everything else. But something which has Hashem's name on it, psukim, have to be going to shemes, have to go to kinis, have to be buried. So what is that halacha of lishma when it comes to dvarim shel mitzvah? So this is a little bit less clear. And in fact, there are different opinions about certain things. And some of the main highlights which present us the halacha with the following applications. Tzitzis is something that requires to be done lishma. The tzitzis must be made lishma. When I say made lishma, what I'm referring to is the making of the strings themselves. I am not yet talking about the connecting of the strings to the garment. The making of the strings themselves have to be done lishma, which we call tviya, the spinning of the wool. Literally, it's what's called tviya lishma. If you look carefully, next time you buy a talus or a pair of tzitzis, you will notice there's a little sticker on it that will tell you the degree of how machmer they were in terms of lishma. What it usually will boil down to is as follows. There was a big machlok, there was a big debate in Europe about 150 years ago or so when machines began to become relevant. Can I simply press a button? Is that called doing something lishma? Does lishma mean I have to sit behind the spinning wheel and actually spin the wool literally lishma? Or can I simply press a button and the whole machine starts and does lishma? There was a big, big dispute about this. It basically boiled down to be almost a machlokas between the Misnagdim and the Hasidim. The Hasidim were very machmer in this, the Misnagdim were a little bit more lenient about this. And the question became, can I have strings of tzitzis that were made at a factory? So if you take a look at your stickers on the tzitzis, they will say either avodas yad or avodas mechonai, either they were made by hand or they were made by machine. If they were made by hand, then it's a little bit more machmir, and as we said before, it's going to cost you a little bit more. The higher quality tzitzis are the ones that are made by hand. Again, they fulfill those opinions and maintain that making it by hand is necessary for lishma. But when we talk about tzitzis, so something fascinating comes up, that although it is clear that the preparation of the wool proper must be done lishma, what is less clear is whether the actual attaching of the strings to the beged must be done lishma. So we are machmer on that. We try to do that, although the Rambam's opinion was, in fact, it's not even necessary. So la halacha, we're not 100% sure that that's true, but we will try as best as we can to be machmer for that. And therefore, la maisa, if a person makes their own tzitzis, many people like to do that. There are some who say there's a chumah lechatchil if one is able to make their own tzitzis, to connect the strings to the beged and make the knots and the ties, etc. If one does that, one should really try to remember to say L'shei mitzvah tzitzis before one begins. One need not repeat L'shei mitzvah tzitzis 4,000 times. One can say it at the beginning, and then pretty much that carries over for the duration of as long as it takes you to make the tzitzis. So lishma is important for us in tzitzis. It's definitely important in terms of the tviya proper, and it's to a certain degree important in terms of the making as well. What about other chafotz? What about other objects that are not dvarim shel kedusha? They're not gittin, they're not sefer Torah, tefillin, mezuzahs. The Dvarim Shel Mitzvah, do they also have to be lishma? And again, the answer to each one of these questions depends on the Cheftz itself and based on Psukim and Drashas, Tashabach Sa, Tashabach Peh, different opinions, and some of them are actually subject to debate. But one of the important questions that comes up, of course, is the issue of matzah. Is it necessary that matzah be baked lishma or not? So when I talk about matzah, I am not talking about the matzah that you take on your trip on Chol HaMoed on the third day. I'm talking about the matzah you eat the Seder. That's the Ikar Mitzvah of this matzah. That's the obligation in the Torah of eating matzah. Obviously, you can't eat chametz the rest of the week, but if you choose not to eat matzah the rest of the week, that's okay. But the real chiyuv, the real obligation of eating matzah is by the Lev HaSeder. Must that matzah actually be made, be baked l'shma? So that's a big, big question. So we paskin in halacha that yes, that the preparation of the matzah has to be done l'shma. Not only do we paskin that the matzah has to be l'shma, what we call really a shmur matzah, but there's also a question how far back in the process must the matzah be guarded and must the l'shma, according to many, be implemented. So the biggest chumrah of all the opinions is what's called matzah mishas ketzira, that the grain is guarded and it's processed l'shma all the way back from the time of the harvesting of the grain. That's the biggest chumrah. There is a machlokas in the Gemara, machlokas in the Rishonim, but when the matzahs that we use by the Lel Hasei there are always going to be matzah shmur mishas ketzira. As we mentioned before, concerning the tzitzis, there are some opinions that maintain that the machine matzahs would meet that requirement. Others maintain machine matzahs would not. They would fall short in terms of those requirements. So you have different opinions. Like Hasidim, they would never, ever be caught eating machine matzahs on for the Lel HaSeder or for the rest of Pesach for that matter. Whereas the some Misnagdim do actually use them for the Seder, and many don't. So again, there are different opinions about what the status of the machine matzahs would be. But everybody agrees, to some degree, you have to have Lishma. For some degree, whether it means all the way back for the Ktsira, or slightly before that. It's interesting, I remember, you can even see a little bit about the evolving of the American Jewish community. When I was a little boy, so I grew up in Riverdale. Riverdale at the time was a small Jewish community, you know, back in the late 60s, early 70s. It wasn't what it is today. And there was no Shmur Matzah. It was, to the best of my knowledge, there was no place in Riverdale to buy Shmur Matzah. I remember that my parents, my father, Shalom, used to travel to Washington Heights. We had one box of Shmur Matzah. You buy one box of Shmur Matzah, it would last us for the two Sedarim. There were a couple of pieces afterwards, and that was it. At Khan, it was impossible. Everybody ate the regular amount of Shevitz, Harvitz, Margaret, and the regular plain old matzahs, you know, like the rest of Kleistral. Hey, it just wasn't even on anyone's radar screen to be eating matzah, Shmur Matzah the whole week. The Rambam's Chumras, that hadn't made it yet to Riverdale in the 1970s. So I marveled how things have changed over the years. This goes back already about 10, 11 years ago. So my father, Avshalom, was in the hospital. He was in the hospital. I had to take him to the hospital on Achron Shel Pesach. It was at night. It was just the seventh day of Pesach just ended. And he had to be rushed to the hospital that night. So I accompanied him to the hospital for the Achron Shel Pesach. And I hadn't had a chance even to make Kiddush or my Sudur or anything. I'm literally in the hospital in the emergency room with him on Achron Shel Pesach. In a hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, known as Holy Name, a Catholic hospital. And, you know, it was about 3-4 hours into the night, and my father said to me, you know, make Kiddush already. What are you doing here? So he wanted me to make Kiddush. I said, okay, wait 5 minutes. I ran up to the Bikkur Cholim room to try to scrounge around, to try to find some bottle of grape juice, and to find maybe, I thought maybe I'll find some matzah, I'll dig up some food or something, have a little soup, a little mashu. I walked into a Catholic hospital on the night of Achron Shel Pesach, and I had my choice. I could have pupa matzahs, I had shatza matzahs, I had kabad matzahs, I had satma matzah. Out of four or five different choices, kiyat hamelech, of every possible shmur mishas ketzira, each box costing $60, $70, my heart's delight. So life had changed in America over the last 40 years. But the bottom line is, the matzah's got to be shmura, and we're machmer that should be shmura, as best shmura as it possibly can be. The making of the box doesn't have to be l'shmura. The making of the box has to be l'shmura. In contrast to tzitzis and the matzah, where there is some kind of a requirement of l'shma, so interestingly enough, sukkah is actually a mitzvah that doesn't require l'shma. There's one Tana of Beishan who says you have to build your sukkah l'shma. We don't pass like that. We pass that a sukkah me'ikra din does not have to be built l'shma. It could have been built for some other reason. A person wanted to make a little bit of, have a nice shade in the backyard. Technically speaking, that's okay. Nevertheless, l'chatchila mid'rabbanan, one's supposed to make a little bit of the sukkah l'shma. You're supposed to throw a couple of pieces of bamboo on for good luck l'shma. But the ikmikra din, even if you didn't do that, so the sukkah is technically k'shera. So out of all the chafotzim shel mitzvah, sukkah kind of loses out. So how do we know this? Where does this come from? How come matzah, yeah, tzitzis, yeah, this, no, yeah, yeah. So the Rishonim write, aim lo alegzeres hakosov. There's a posuk here that says matzah here, posuk says tzitzis here, no posuk here, no posuk there. Kach gozo hachachmas HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has told us which mitzvahs here, which mitzvahs no. So there's a general rule that Dvarim Shebe Kedusha require, get for sure requires, when you're in the realm of Dvarim Shebe Mitzvah, that it's not literally pick and choose, they're not pick and choosing, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Chachmas have decided which Chafatash HaMitzvah require or not. When we speak about Lishma, there's a major machlokes in the Rishonim. What does Lishma mean? when I'm about to bake the matzahs, I'm about to write the get, I'm about to write the Sefer Torah, when that sofer tells me to fill in that last letter, does the Shema mean I have to verbalize it, I have to say it, or is it enough for a person simply to just think it? I'm just thinking the Shema, that's good enough. That's a major dispute in the Rishonim. And minig is lahachmer in that. So before a get is written, the sofer spells out l'shma orally before the matzahs are baked. Anyone who's ever baked matzahs, they know that they scream and yell, l'shai matzahs mitzvah, l'shai matzahs mitzvah. And the sofer will tell you, say these words, l'shem, k'dusha sefer Torah. We're, of course, machmer to say it. Why would we get involved in the shayla? The Mishnah Berurah is makil, and so under certain circumstances, when you have situations where we're not even sure you needed l'shma in the first place, and by mistake you forgot to say it, but you had it in mind, maybe it would be okay. This is an important clue to know for making tzitzit. Sometimes a person goofs, and they tied all the strings, and then they remember an hour later, oh, by golly, I forgot to say l'shma. So the Mishnah Berurah is makil, because remember we mentioned a few minutes ago that the Rambam holds, you don't really have to connect the strings l'shma anyway. So it's a little sveit sveit, like a double doubt. Maybe you don't have to connect it l'shma, and maybe, you know, it's possible that even without diba, without actually verbalizing, would be acceptable. So sometimes you run into these like gray areas whether it needs lishma. But under normal circumstances, lishma has to be said. Who can say lishma? So the Gemara is very clear in Masechas Gittin that only a Jew can say lishma. A non-Jew cannot say lishma. What is not clear is why is that true? That's a big machlokes in Rishonim. So there's some Rishonim who say that a non-Jew cannot write a get lishma because he's not going to pay attention for a half hour. He doesn't take this whole thing. It's not his religion. He doesn't take this thing seriously. So he's not going to be able to hold cup for a half hour to do something with Shema. And the Rambam seems to say, it's nothing to do with his inability to think with Shema. Api halacha, you have to be Jewish in order to create the Shema. Non-Jew, api halacha, is mufka. He's excluded from the whole parasha of the Shema. What's the difference when you say, like Rashi, who seems to say it's a technicality that he can't pay attention, and the Rambam who says it's a halacha? So remember going back to the guilds of the Middle Ages. What if you have a process that takes about 1 second? It takes you 1 second to dump the skins into the solution. So came a group of Rishonim and said, there'd been a Baruch and the Rosh, Ashkenazi Rishonim and said, if it's only a split second, then it's okay. Then the non-Jew can help couple stand over him, will tell him, do it lishma, do it lishma, do it lishma. He'll do it lishma. He can figure out how to do it lishma. The Rambam says nothing doing. The Rambam says, I don't care whether it's an hour process, I don't care whether it's a 1 second process, a non-Jew cannot create lishma. So the good luck for the Rambam that is that in Egypt where he lived, the Jews were able to produce the animal skins. But where the Rush lived, it wasn't working. So Machlekes Rishonim, can you rely on the non-Jews to do things for you if it's a very, very short amount of time? There is a fascinating parallel concept, what's called Gadol Omer Al Gabav. We spoke a lot about this in Yeshiva this year. What if you have a child, you have a katan who's doing something, and usually we assume a child is a lav bar das, he can't really affect halachic, you know, thought processes. What if an adult is standing over him and giving him instructions, saying, do it lishma, do it lishma, do it lishma. So the Gemara in Gittin actually talks about the possibility of a child writing a get, the most serious of all under those circumstances. That's a big, big question. It's for this reason that we try to avoid, some Rishonim don't like this, it's a big question about this, we try to avoid this Gadol Omer Al Gabav when we don't have to. By baking matzahs, we generally don't like to have children baking matzahs, we like to have adults baking matzahs. Now sometimes your kid may come home with this little tiny matzah that they baked, and they're so proud, the 8-year-old, to tell you, I baked this matzah all by myself, that's wonderful, let them eat that matzah at the Seder. You shouldn't be eating that matzah at the Seder. Now, I didn't say that yotze with that matzah, it's a big machlok, yes, but it's probably not the lechem chayim. I mean, at the price of £60, $60 per box or something, you want to get matzah that's good l'chol ha'deis. You don't want to walk away from the matzah that says, well, you have to be sure I'm saying that matzah is really no good anyway. So stay away from the kids' matzahs. The kids' tzitzis are also a fascinating thing. A lot of schools like to teach the kids to make a tzitzis, so it gets a little bit tricky about that. You have to have a Gadol Omer Al Gabav for that one. I'll close with a story that we had back in NTSY Kollel several years ago. It was in the summer of the war in Gaza, the war in, I forget how many years ago it was, 7-8 years ago. So the second war in Gaza. So we were We were sent up to Chespin, up to the north, to keep away from the missiles. So we had a whole, 250-300 NCS wires sitting in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of Chespin, and trying as best as we can to learn. And we had to kind of, find other things to do to keep the kids occupied. Many of our tulim had been canceled. So all of a sudden, one night, it's about 11 o'clock at night, some fellow from Yerushalayim pulls up with a van, and he says he has a project for us to do. Who was it? Eliyahu HaNavi? His project was as follows. He was sent by the army, by Tzal, with 500 begodim and 500 sets of strings, and they need, by the next morning, on the Gaza front, 500 pairs of tzitzis. Why? Because they wanted to have green begodim. They wanted to have camouflage begodim. They didn't have enough. So they needed a place for somebody to quickly mass produce them tzitzis. And somebody gave them the tip. There were 250 Americans sitting around having nothing, trying to figure out what in the world to do with themselves. So kacha, 11 o'clock, we started a tzitzis marathon around the clock. And the guy took them 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, down, started driving back to Gaza with them. But we had a little bit of an issue with those tzitzis, is that we had a bunch of little kids, some of the kids in the families. I remember that summer had no bedtime. I remember my kids were up to, it was Yom Lila that summer. So we had a bunch of little kids under the age of Amitsu who wanted to participate. So I said, great. I gave a hoshia for about 7 minutes about Godel Omer Agabov, and I was the Godel. And I went around from kid to kid telling them, do it l'shma. And I went to the next one, do it l'shma. Every kid, I was round and round and round every time, do it l'shma. The post was after mama, tell them a few times, do it l'shma. So we were making like those Rishonim, the Shasar Chak. Everything that someone's a Shasar Chak. So we were making that we had begodim and tzitzis that were made ayyadei Godel Omer Agabov. So the halachos of the Shema really do come up. They come up in our gittin, in our sefer Torah, in our matzahs, in our sukkahs, maybe not, an array of different areas. So we have to always ask ourselves these different questions. Number one, does this particular chefza require lishma? Which part of the process of this chefza requires lishma? Does the Shema necessitate a deep work and it suffice with the machshava? And who is acceptable, the Jew, non-Jew, child, as an adult, in terms of great lishma? When we come to the answers to all those questions, then we'll be able to put into actual practice halacha l'maisa, how we go ahead with this halacha lishma throughout all the different mitzvahs that appear throughout the year. Okay.